Hey everybody, this is Joe from HomeStudioCorner.com. Time for another round of Ask Joe. This is number 31. So thanks for sticking around. Thanks for listening. Got a bunch of questions. Can't promise I'll get through them all today. You guys are really following the protocol well for sending in questions. So thank you all those of you who have sent questions in. Again, you can send those in at AskJoeGilder.com. And before I jump into the questions, real quickly, for those of you sending in questions, I may skip over a couple. Most of you are really good about sending in nice short questions. Some of you send in really, really long ones. And those long ones I will probably have to skip over just because of time constraints. I want to get through as many questions, but I want to make sure they help as many people. So typically those really, really long-winded questions are so specific, it's going to be hard to really help you out, but I'll try to do my best here. All right, so the first question is from David. David says, Joe, great resource you're providing. Keep it up. I'm going to kind of paraphrase his. It's one of the longer ones. Says, I play guitar and run sound in a few bands. Has Logic and uses an Apogee of some sort as his interface. I do lots of concepts and demo recording, and I almost always throw EQ, multiband compression, and limiting on the master bus for these projects. I vary the way I mix. Sometimes these are bypassed, other times are not. But when I bounce these, they're always pretty loud for iPod / car listening and reviewing. I have yet to do much bouncing of mixes and then mastering them in a separate session, and while I'm happy about the results, I often feel like I'm jumping the gun and the mix or EQ / compression fatigue might be hurting my efforts. So to make a long question short, does the traditional mix, bounce, master, bounce process yield better results than the mix, master, bounce shortcut? Okay, let me paraphrase his question. He's simply asking, generally the process of recording and mixing goes like this. You record everything, you mix it down, then you bounce that as a stereo file, then you take that stereo file, bring it into a new session, whatever software you use, and you master that stereo file separately. Now, there's no rule that says you can't do all that while mixing, so put your compression, your EQ, your multiband compression, and your limiting on the master fader while you're mixing. But I tend to want to separate those, and a lot of people tend to work that way as well. Because mastering and mixing are just two different mindsets, and it's really hard to do either one of them very well if you're also doing the other one. For example, if I'm working on a mix and I've got a multiband compressor and a limiter on the master fader, and I'm having trouble getting the bass level right. Well, I may turn up the bass fader in the mix, but then the multiband compressor is going to turn that down or make that sound a certain way. And while I get the idea that you're listening to the final product, I feel like you're kind of shortchanging yourself because you can focus more on just getting the mix right, and then you can get in a new mindset and focus on just getting the master right if you do them in sequence like that. So I don't have anything against you doing it that way, but I feel like you probably get better results by separating those two tasks and doing them independently. For me, that seems to work well, and that seems to be the way most people do it. Because we're just not, as humans, we're just not very good at multitasking as much as we like to think we are. Okay, next up is Alan. Alan has a question about WAV files and MIDI tracks. Let's see, this is a little four-part question. First part, and Alan is from the UK, Southeast Coast in the UK. Question number one, should I render down a MIDI track to a WAV file and then import that into a mix console? Will timing be an issue? Okay, Alan, I don't really know what you're asking there. If you're running your mix through a console, there's no reason to render that MIDI file down to a WAV if it's just being sent out to a mixer anyway. That's not going to do anything for your audio, except for when you render those, it does let you turn off that virtual instrument, which can save processing power, which is certainly a good thing to do if you need it. Second question, should I leave the MIDI track and use it in the console mix? Okay, so yeah, I would just leave it that way, unless you're running out of power. Third question, is it necessary to EQ / compress MIDI tracks? Okay, this is a good question. This is a question I actually get a lot, and it's a little, I didn't foresee this being a question I would get a lot, but it is one I get fairly regularly. So, Alan, thank you for asking it. The question essentially is, if I'm using a lot of samples, a lot of virtual instruments, a lot of, quote, fake instruments in my productions, do I need to do any EQ or compression on those? Now, the first part of that is if you're using, say, Easy Drummer, which has professionally sampled drum sounds in it, chances are those sounds were EQ'd and compressed some during the sampling process when they actually recorded and edited and created those samples for you. So it's probably going to have a more polished sound right out of the box. That said, just because you're using samples does not mean you're excluded from having to use your ears and be creative and be a mix engineer when you're mixing. There's just no way around it. You have to listen and decide, does this need EQ? Not because Joe said so, not because I'm using real instruments or MIDI instruments, but listen to it. Is there something that needs to be EQ'd? And the same thing for compression. Does it need some compression to get it to sit in the mix how I want it to sound, or to get it to have that tone that I want? And those should be the question you're asking, not since it's a MIDI file, should I not use EQ and compression? I've talked about this before. Asking should I questions almost never are helpful, because the answer is going to be, well, does it sound good or not? That's always going to be the answer. If you're wondering, should I run my lead vocal through a distortion pedal and out to a big Marshall half stack and then record that back in? I don't know. Does it sound good? Does it work for the song? That's going to be your answer. So I know that's kind of a cop-out answer, but it's reality. That's how I would answer it if I was asking myself that question. That's what I would say. And last question from Alan, are there MIDI tutorials anywhere on your site? I haven't made an in-depth like tutorial video product, partly because I use MIDI a fair amount, but it's not the center of most of my work that I do. I use it for add-on things, and usually I have the majority of my stuff is audio with a couple of MIDI tracks. So I just don't have a ton there that I do with MIDI, but I do have an intro to MIDI video. I'll make a note here to put that in the show notes here. Real quickly about show notes. As you know, when I reference different websites and links and articles and things like that, I'm going to include those in the blog post for this episode of Ask Joe. And to make that easier for you to get to, then I'm just making the URL a lot easier. So you can just go to homestudiocorner.com/askjoe31. That's all you got to do. So homestudiocorner.com/askjoe31. This is episode 31. I probably won't go back and change all the old links, but from here on out, if I say, hey, go back and check the show notes, that's where you can find it. Okay, Alan, thanks for the question. Great stuff. Evan, who is one of my VIP members, has a question. Says he's from Kentucky and asks, what kind of strategies would you recommend for gaining clients in a rural area? First of all, the word rural is impossible to say. So thank you, Evan, for making me say that on a podcast. And secondly, that's a good question. I grew up in rural Mississippi, and I know how small towns can be. And now I obviously live in Nashville, and there's just on every street corner is a guitarist who is 10 times better than me. So it's not hard to find musicians and talent here. But that's a great question, because most people, I would imagine, that are fans of Home Studio Corner don't live here in Nashville or don't live in big cities where there's just a ton of resources there. And what I say a lot of times when people ask this question is go to where the musicians are. The musicians, they're making music somewhere. Maybe that's in a nearby town where there's more venues and places for them to play. Maybe they hang out and maybe there's a songwriters group. Maybe there's just a place where people go to jam, local bars, and just different places like that. Where are the musicians playing their music? And that's where you want to be if you're going to want to meet them and play with them. Another place, this may not apply to everybody, but if I've met a lot of musicians through different social events like church, it's just a group of people that I'm around a lot, and I find out that this guy is a drummer, this guy is a bass player, and I just end up meeting them also through, I'm a musician as well, so I do music at the church, so that helps me meet a lot of people. I'm not condoning taking up going to church just so you can build your business necessarily, but it's a good place. Just thinking the different circles that you already run in, are there places there that you could maybe dive a little deeper to find clients? And another thing is if you can get some work doing live sound. Even if it's just a coffee shop one night a week where you run the little 4-channel Mackie mixer for the singer-songwriters that are going to play that night, that's a great place to obviously meet musicians because you're right there working with them, running their sound. Maybe that's something you start yourself. Maybe there's nothing like that in your town. Maybe you can convince a local venue of some sort, a coffee shop or a bar, to help you maybe buy some of the equipment, or you can buy it and take it in and offered to do a free writer's night. You'll run the sound for it one night a week, Tuesday nights, and then you promote that to the local community and draw the musicians to you. That might be a great way to do it. And don't talk about recording necessarily and promise to be, you know, to do a recording session or anything like that, but you're just introducing and finding ways to meet these people, and eventually that could maybe turn into clients. If you want to get real fancy, you could get something like PreSonus has their Studio Live consoles that I use. They're more expensive, but if you've got one or can swing one, you could use that to run sound for the show, and you could even bring your laptop and record, multi-track record the entire event, whatever the event is. Then you've got something already recorded that you could offer to mix for them, or say, hey, we can do this more professionally if you want to come back to my studio and we'll really lay something down. So those are a couple of options that come off the top of my head. I actually did a training session for my VIP members a few months ago, and it was essentially, I think, 46 or 47 different ways to get new clients. So I went through a bunch of these same ideas, different things that I've come up with, and I also asked probably 6 or 7 other engineers ways that they get clients. And I compiled it into a huge list, and I go through all of them in the training video that's inside the members area. And I also have it as a PDF for you to kind of go through and maybe keep in your studio to kind of refresh you with some different ideas. But that's available if you want to become a VIP member at homestudiocorner.com/VIP. You get access to any new training that I do. I do a new training video once a month, VIP forums, and also any of the past VIP sessions, which there's at least 15 of them now, each of them at least an hour long. So lots of good stuff for $5 a month currently. So check that out at homestudiocorner.com/VIP. Next up is David Dewar from Nashville. David is actually a friend of mine. And his question has to do with biting off more than you can chew. How do you handle when you realize that you have created slash accepted a project too big than you can handle? Or is there a project too big for a home studio recordist? How do you approach failure in the midst of a project? So those are three, kind of, that third question is different, but the first two kind of, it's a very interesting question because, like Evan just asked, how do you find clients? But then at some point, if you have a lot of clients, then you're kind of asking yourself, okay, what types of clients can I work with? What types of clients do I want to work with? And what types of clients am I even capable of working with? For me personally, if I have a band that wants to record a full band project, I'm not set up in my home studio to track drums. I don't have enough mics. I've got enough inputs, but I don't have enough microphones, mic stands, or even just physical room to do a full tracking session. Not to mention that there is a 1.5-year-old baby running around who will make that near impossible. So what do I do? Well, I do a couple of different things. If it's a singer-songwriter who just wants music and tracks put together for his project, for his album or whatever, then I can go to my different friends that I know that record those pieces. So my buddy Tim Horsley, who plays drums, he's got an awesome drum recording setup in his basement. He's a pro drummer who actually is really good at recording drums. I have him record them. And if they need a bass player, I get my brother-in-law Joel to play bass on it. So it's almost you farm out these pieces of the pie and you just pay them to record the parts, get them back to you, and then you work from there. So that's one way that I can go about handling things that it doesn't make sense for me to buy 15 more microphones and mic stands and mic cables for a full tracking session if I'm rarely going to do that. That doesn't make sense for me in my home studio. In most home studios, it might not make sense. For you, maybe it does. And if so, go for it, get all that stuff, and you can accept those projects. But for me, the current space that I'm in, there's just not enough room to do that. But that doesn't mean I have to turn down those bigger projects. And as far as a project being too big to handle, I don't know if I have any hard and fast rules for that. I've worked on projects that I thought would be easy that turned into something bigger, but the challenges have been good and things that make me better at things that maybe I wasn't very good at before. And also, there's just, if you are upfront and open and honest, you should have a pretty good idea of what the project is going to entail from the beginning, and you just work from there. So an example is I worked with a local producer here in Nashville who was producing a low-budget album for an independent artist out of Los Angeles, and so we ended up recording a lot of the tracks in my studio at her house, and she tracked the drums in a real studio, and then we did the rest at my place and her place. and she had professionals record a string section, and it was really cool, sounded awesome. And I had not mixed strings in that way before. They took a single cello player, a single violin player, put them in a room, and had them record the parts multiple times, sitting in multiple positions. And then, so there was probably 8 to 10 stereo tracks of strings that were just two people overdubbed over and over on top of each other. And it sounded amazing. And I'd never mixed that before. And I could have said, oh, I've never mixed that specifically before. I should not accept this project. I said, you know what? I'll make it sound good. And I did. I worked on it and made it sound good. And it ended up actually being a lot easier than I thought because they were recorded so well, already sounded really good. But it depends on your comfort level. If it's a style of music you've never worked on, so if somebody came up to me and wanted to do a hip-hop record and wanted me to do everything, they had the lyrics and they just wanted me to create all the music, that one I would have to turn down. I don't make beats. I don't know how to use an MPC at all. When I worked at Sweetwater, we did product demos as a part of our training. We'd pick a product that we're not familiar with and do a demonstration. Well, genius that I was, this white boy with no rhythm, I picked the MPC 1000 to do a demonstration of, and it was just awful. So I am not the one to come to for anything of that nature. If they're wanting to do a regular rock band, a folk thing, acoustic-based demo thing, all of those things I'm very comfortable with. Even if it was more of a Chicago-style band and they're going to have horns and different things like that, but a typical band setup, I'm great for that. If it was maybe an a cappella record, that I've not done as much of. I know I've got a buddy who knows that really well, so I may take on the project and hire him to help me or consult with him for ideas of the best ways to do that, or I might just refer them to somebody who's done that and can do it faster than me. It's just a matter of really finding out what's expected of you and then deciding if you're able to deliver on that. And that, obviously, that goes for anything aside from just recording, but that would be my answer to a really good question. And that final part, David, that you asked, how do you approach failure in the midst of a project? I don't know. It depends on how you define failure. If I send them a mix that they're not happy with, then I go back and I fix it, and I have confidence that I can make the changes they want me to make. And I set expectations, of course. If they recorded something, I didn't get to record it, and they're just sending me the tracks to mix, and they were recorded really poorly, well, then, yeah, I'm going to say, here's what I can do. I can go back and make a few changes, but because of the way the tracks sound, I can't work a miracle here. They weren't recorded as well as I would want them to be. And you have to kind of be honest and upfront with them, and then they'll say, oh, okay. Good to know. But yeah, expectations is key because they may think that you can take anything and make it sound super pristine when it really matters. It really doesn't work that way. You have to have good source material before you can move on and make it sound amazing. Next up is Chris. Chris is another VIP member. You guys are jumping on the question train here, which is awesome. Chris asks about buying your first studio monitors. He says, and Chris is from Phoenix, Arizona. Says, great podcast, Joe. Do you have any advice for someone buying their first set of studio monitors? If I'm at a big music store listening to 5 different sets of monitors, what am I listening for? Can you recommend a specific model or brand, or should I buy a nice set of headphones instead, like the Sennheiser HD650 headphones? Ride the chicken, Chris. If you're not a VIP member, you won't get the chicken reference, but I believe he has a pet chicken that he has in his studio, which is awesome and hilarious at the same time. Okay, so to answer your questions, first set of studio monitors. For those of you who don't know studio monitors, we're just talking about those speakers that you have, your studio speakers. They're called studio monitors. They're monitor speakers for you to monitor your mix. And I would say, first and foremost, don't go super cheap or super small. So if you're getting something that's a little desktop speaker that has a little 2.5 or 3-inch woofer on it, yes, it could be a good speaker to check your mixes on, but it's just not going to have enough low end to really reproduce the mix and get it to sound good. Where most of us have problems in our mixes, or a big problem area at least, is the actual low end of the mix. Making sure the bass and the drums and everything else that has that low frequency information, make sure that still sounds good and is balanced. And if your speakers are tiny and can't even reproduce those frequencies, then you have no idea how your low end is going to work. So I would say something, at least maybe a 5-inch woofer or bigger would be a good starting point. I know you can get into some that are $100 for a small little speaker. It's just the kind of thing that it'd be better for you just to pocket that money and save up and spend a couple $100 at least, preferably more. That this is definitely a you get what you pay for type of purchase, up to probably $1,000. And just get something that's big enough to reproduce the low end. You can look at the specs. You can look at how they're rated, the frequency response, frequency curves, and all that. Each manufacturer reports those differently, so you're not going to be able to really compare a set of M-Audios to a set of Alesis or something and look at those graphs side by side and really be able to tell anything useful. Part of me just wants to go off the recommendation of somebody else who has used them and mixed them. Online reviews are great for that. Go to someplace like Sweetwater.com. Their website's pretty good about having reviews from customers on there. And also from sales guys who, a lot of people don't know this, but the sales guys at Sweetwater, I used to be one of them, a lot of the manufacturers will actually leave gear in this big closet at Sweetwater that sales guys can check out and take home to their home studio. And a lot of the speaker manufacturers will do that as well. So that gives those guys a chance to take them home over a weekend and work on some mixes or just listen to them in a controlled mixing environment of their home studio that they're comfortable with and get a good idea of how they sound. So I would say listening to them in a big box store is only going to help you. It's not terribly helpful because it's not an ideal listening environment. A lot of times you don't have choice over the source material and it may or may not be treated very well. And it's just really hard. I would say if you're going to do that, at least take some sort of source music that you're familiar with. For me, it's something like One Headlight from Wallflowers Bringing Down the Horse or something. It's just a song that I know really well. I've listened to on every system I've ever listened on. So I know what that's supposed to sound like. So if I listen to that on those speakers and it sounds pretty close to what I'm expecting it to sound like, then I know they're fairly accurate. They're not doing anything crazy to the sound. Other than that, you really need to just get the speakers in your space and listen to them. And as long as they're not crap speakers and they're not super hyped speakers that are just adding a bunch of low and high frequencies just to make things sound quote unquote good, as long as they're fairly accurate and designed for that, it really comes down to just picking a pair and using them and learning how to mix on them. I know that's kind of another one of those cop-out answers, but that really is pretty helpful because no matter what your speakers are, you've got to learn them, and they're going to sound different in your room than they will anywhere else, and where you place them in your room is going to make a big difference. So for me, changing rooms that I'm using for my studio have made my speakers sound a lot different. The low end is completely different depending on what room I'm in because of the different acoustics of that room and how that interacts with the speakers. So the speakers are important, but they're only one part of the puzzle. And I would just say if you can find somebody you trust who's used them or you get a good feeling about a pair, just go for them, bring them home, and just start mixing on them. And the cool thing about places like Sweetwater is you can return them. You got to pay to ship them back. But if you're just miserable with them, there's always an out there if you want to return those and try a different pair. Now, at the end of your question, you asked about just skipping over speakers and getting a really nice set of headphones. I've got the HD 650 headphones from Sennheiser, which I'm actually wearing right now. They're very comfortable. And it's a great set of headphones. They're around $500, so an expensive set of headphones. However, if you think about getting a good set of speakers, a really good set of speakers, you could drop $2,000 fairly quickly to get a nice high-end set of speakers. And like I said before, those speakers are good, but if you put them in a crappy room, that room is going to affect the sound so much that you might not get all the benefit out of those nicer speakers. Headphones, however, are a different story because your room has zero impact on the sound of your headphones because they're right over your ears. Now, the Sennheiser HD 650, they're an open-back headphone, so they're not good for recording because they can bleed. Everything bleeds out of the headphones, but because they're that open-back design, they actually have a really good frequency response. There's other things involved, but that's a part of it, is they have a very deep low end that you don't expect to get out of headphones. So there's plenty of discussions out there of should you mix and do other audio work on headphones versus speakers, and there's pros and cons to all of it, but a good set of headphones, especially if you're not in a place where you can really treat your room well, might be a really good thing to add to your studio arsenal. And there's plenty of brands out there, Ultrasone, I know Shure started making headphones that I hear sound pretty good. AKG is really well known for their headphones as well, some of their higher end stuff. But I love Sennheiser. I've got their HD280 closed back headphones for tracking that I love, and I've got these HD650s for mixing and just more critical listening, mastering. I'll use those to check mastering mixes just to make sure that my speakers aren't lying to me. So they're a good set of headphones, worth at least considering and looking at when you're having that discussion about upgrading your monitoring system. All right, quick break for coffee and we'll move on. All right, next up is someone from Guatemala named Spiritus Umbrarum. sorry if I butchered that. And it says, earnings for new studio in 1 year. All right, that's interesting. The question is, how much money can a new studio earn in 1 year? I know that this question is relative to the quality of the studio, the publicity, other factors, etc., and even luck. The thing is that I have to put a number in the registration form for my business. Thanks for your answer. Well, unfortunately, I can't give you an answer. That, like you said, there are so many variables. That's like saying if I opened a banana stand, for those of you who watch Arrested Development, what am I going to make in the first year? That's going to depend on a lot of things. Are my frozen bananas any good? Is it in a good location? Am I doing any marketing? Am I good at making them? Is there a market to sell them? All that type of stuff. A studio is just the same thing. It's a service business. Just like if you opened a lawn care company, what can you make? You could make a crap load of money or you could make nothing. And it just depends on you and your ability to get out there and get business, and also your ability to do good work. So there's really that registration form for your business. If you're starting there, you're probably looking in the wrong direction. If you're not actually doing any work and making any money, you can probably hold off on filling out the business license, see if you can actually make money doing this, and then figure out the business license as you go. Make up a number, put it in there, maybe set yourself a goal and put that there. That'd be a lot better than just guessing and hoping. Is make a goal that you're going to make so much money, you know, in the next 3 months from recording or whatever. And just like with anything else, it takes a lot of work, a lot of skill, maybe a little bit of luck, but that's the best answer I can give you. Hope that helps. Next up is Felipe, and doesn't say where Felipe is from, but he has a question. He's been watching Into the Lair on Pensado's Place, which if you haven't checked out Pensado's Place, I've not watched a ton of them, but it's Dave Pensado, who's a monster mix engineer, just worked on lots and lots of major release stuff. But he's got this, I think it's a weekly live show, and there's a section on there called Into the Lair, where he shows different tricks in his studio. So it's interesting stuff. I've watched a few of them. It definitely gives you new ideas for stuff. Anyway, he says he was watching this and was amazed by how aggressive he is with dynamics. He uses a very hot level on his tracks by using limiters on each track. He often uses a stack of limiters on a single track, one after the other. Is there some kind of technique or concept behind this? You know, that's a good question, Felipe. I don't know. Dave Pensado is a better mix engineer than I am, and at least he is a professional, has worked on major label releases, and I have not. So maybe he knows something we don't. I tend to not want to do lots of limiters and things on my tracks. But again, the examples he uses in his tracks are very different from the stuff that I'm working on. My stuff is very folk. I want some dynamic in mine. His stuff is very much more like electronic pop music. The examples that I've heard that you can kind of slam those because that's kind of the sound of that genre now. So I don't know. I'm sure there absolutely is technique to it, and you've got to understand how limiters and compressors work and the benefits and drawbacks to all of those. And another big takeaway point is he's probably spent countless hours using these plugins in all sorts of different scenarios and different settings and different levels and finding the sweet spots on all of those. So maybe there's a limiter that when you really push it, it adds this really cool sound. And you wouldn't know that without trying it. And, you know, a big part of this audio thing is to know the guidelines and kind of the what you should be looking for. But then those rules weren't meant to be followed. Break the rules and do something that sounds great. And I think any mix engineer, if you watch the way they work, they may break the rules. But as long as the end result sounds good and the client's happy and they're paying you, you're in good shape. Felipe has a second question. Says, I've heard a music producer talking about mixing at home, but renting a professional studio just to print the mix using outboard summing and better A to D converters. I remember that you have a Eureka preamp, and I'm just curious if you have used the converters on your main interface, or do you have the optional A to D converter for your Eureka? and what's your take on the benefit of using dedicated converters, if it makes a difference in audio quality? Okay, there's a couple of questions there. First off, the idea of taking your mix that you finished and printing it on another system. There's not really a way to do that accurately, because if you've got a mix in the box, in Pro Tools, let's say, and you take it to another studio and you're going to run it out through a console, so you're going to run the kick drum through its own console and all of that, well, that's going to mess up your gain, not your gain staging, that's going to mess up your level balance between all the tracks. So if it's the same idea for using a summing box, if you mix in the box and then you just route those tracks out to some sort of summing mixer, summing amp, things like that, chances are the differences in dynamic in those boxes and all those things are going to come into play, and the level between your tracks is going to be different, so you're going to have to adjust those, which is going to change your mix fairly dramatically. The other thing is your room is going to be different from their room, so not that one is necessarily better than the other, but the mix is going to sound different. You're going to make changes when you get there to print that mix anyway, so I don't know if that's necessarily a very beneficial thing either. But the idea I've heard people say with Pro Tools specifically, take a mix that you've done in LE and just open it up on an HD system and theoretically it sounds better. I've not done it, so I can't speak to that. They say that's what happens sometimes. Maybe that's true. But as far as your question about converters, there is certainly a place, a time and a place to have upgraded external converters, so A to D, analog to digital, digital to analog converters, apart from your audio interface. But I tend to think for most home studios, there are lots of other places where you can make a much bigger impact by upgrading than converters. For example, if you've just got one microphone and one way of going about just a small set of equipment and not very good speakers, not a very good sounding room, not a very good preamp, and you're going to upgrade your converters, will you hear a difference? Yeah, you might hear a little bit of a difference if you upgraded your microphone or your preamp or your studio monitors or your interface or any of those hardware analog pieces. Would you hear a bigger difference? I would say yes. I would say the difference would be much bigger upgrading the analog side of things. So if even just upgrading your cabling might make a bigger difference going from cheap cables to good cables over upgrading the converters. I tend to say the converter should be the last upgrade in your system. Once you've upgraded the front end, mics, cables, preamps, any other outboard gear, the back end, again, cables and your studio monitors, and then also your room as far as acoustic treatment and really treating and tuning your room, then you would be in a position to really benefit from converters. Aside from that, I feel like it's not a discussion most home studio folks need to have. There's a lot more that they could probably be better use of their time to spend time on those other areas, or just spend time on themselves and getting better at making good recordings with what they own. So that's what I would say. Next up is a question from Teddy, who says he's from Disneyland, and his question is regarding monitors. It says, how does the bass port exit holes in active studio monitors affect the monitor placement? How close to the wall the monitors can be placed, or can the monitors be placed? Example, the Focal CMS50s have a front bass port, and the DynAudio, the DBM50 have a back bass port. This is getting a little technical, but I do know a little bit about this. Essentially, he's talking about wherever the bass port is on your speakers. Some are front-mounted, some are mounted in the rear. The ones mounted on the front, it's different models, every manufacturer is different. And the best advice I can tell you is to just read the documentation for the specific speakers you're looking at. They will tell you how they were designed to be used, because just the location of the port is one part of the equation, but they designed that speaker to be used in an optimal setting, distance from the wall and all that. I would defer to them before anything else. For example, the EX66 M-Audio monitors that I use. I don't think they make them anymore. It's got the dual 6-inch woofers on each speaker. Those are actually designed to face forward, not be angled in towards the listening position. Now, had I not read the manual, I wouldn't have known that, and I would have had them set up incorrectly. They're also meant to be sit vertically and not horizontally, which you may have thought they should be horizontal. Had I not read the manual, I wouldn't have known that, and they just weren't designed to work as well in that configuration. So I would defer to the manufacturer on that. That said, typically if it's got a front-firing bass port, that means it can be theoretically closer to the wall, because that air has a place to exit out the front. And vice versa, if the port is on the back, then there needs to be some space back there so that sound can emanate out the back and actually go somewhere and not be trapped inside the speaker. That said, the closer the speaker is to a wall or to a corner, there is going to be more bass buildup. And some manufacturers use that to their advantage to enhance the low-end response of their speakers. And so they recommend putting them a little closer to the wall. Some of them say moving them further away from the wall makes them more accurate. Then you've got issues of the sound going out the back of the speaker, bouncing off the wall and coming back, and essentially canceling itself out at certain frequencies with itself. So the sound is coming out of the front of the speaker. It's also going out of the back of the speaker, bouncing off the wall, coming back, and blending with the signal coming out of the front of the speaker, only it's delayed by a couple of milliseconds or nanoseconds or whatever. And so that can cause different phase issues. So there's lots of different schools of thought on that. For example, I think the folks from Barefoot make those studio monitors, high-end monitors. They tend to tell you to, I believe, put your speakers out from the wall, whereas Genelec, they tend to tell you to get them as close to the wall or vice versa, I forget. But it's just the way they're designed, so I defer to the manufacturer and how they intended them to be used. And try it. Which one makes you get better mixes? That's a great question as well. Next up is... that one's just a little too long. Next up is Wade from Ontario. This is about virtual drumming. It says, "Hey Joe, I watched your review of Easy Drummer and was wondering if you've used some of the other options such as Steven Slate drums, Addictive drums, etc., or do you think Easy Drummer is the best?" I don't necessarily think Easy Drummer is the best, but it's just the first one that I used and really got into using. And it was simple and I was able to get the job done. I liked the sounds okay, and so I just used it. And so that would be my short answer. I just used it, and I didn't see a reason to find another piece of software. I did try Superior Drummer briefly, but I just wanted to go back to a more simple approach. And so I used it for an entire album, and you've used it on countless other demos and things, and I liked it. Is it fairly limited in its sound set, even if you get the expansion packs? Sure. That's why on my latest album, I'm tracking real drums with my buddy Tim, who I mentioned earlier in the show, and I'll put a link to his website and also Joel in the show notes at homestudiocorner.com/askjoe31. Anyway, but that's a part of that was just I wanted to use real drums. I like the feel of that. I'm good at programming drums, but I don't think like a drummer, and I didn't want to spend the time coming up with drum parts that would just be okay. I wanted a real drummer to just wail away on a drum kit and make it sound really good. Next up is Renee from Panama. Says, "Joe, since I joined HSC, my recording and mixing skills have improved a lot, but my composing sucks. It would be awesome if you can share with us your approach to composing, lyrics, and so on." You know, this is coming up more and more in conversations within the VIP members area, people just emailing me, asking about, excuse me, I tried to be all cool and take a sip of coffee, and that didn't. It didn't work. I choked myself. But people ask me about songwriting and think I should do a songwriting class, and maybe I'll do that one day. But to be honest, I haven't written a song in probably a year at least, so I don't feel like I'm quite qualified to do that yet. But my approach musically, I approach songwriting from two standpoints. One is just the ideas for the concepts of the song from a lyrical standpoint, and then the music. And usually the musical part comes from just doodling on guitar, picking up a guitar and just deciding to just play until I come up with something that just feels good and sounds kind of cool, something that I would want to record and flesh out that's not just the boring same old stuff. Sometimes it's just a matter of putting different chord progressions together. Maybe I'll decide, I haven't written a song in 6/8 time signature in a while. Let me do that. And so I just try to come up with a cool chord progression like that. Or I'll pick a key that I haven't written in a while, or I'll use a capo, a different capo that I've not used before, or different, you know, like a cut capo or play higher up on the neck, all those sorts of things. And a lot of the cool songs that I've come up with have been accidental as far as musically. I'll be playing and I'll accidentally place my finger in the wrong place and it makes an interesting chord or an interesting additional note to a chord that takes my brain to a different place that leads to a different song. So just playing my instrument for me personally is how I end up coming up with ideas for songs. Lyrically, and this has just always been the case for me, I tend to journal a fair amount, write down actually like my thoughts. And you may call me a girl, and that's okay. It's good for me. Not to be called a girl, but the journaling. But that's just something I've always done for years since college. Off and on, it's just writing down stuff that I'm thinking about. And a lot of those end up just fleshing out something I'm thinking about or working through personally, ends up little phrases in that come out and stick out as something that would be a good lyric for a song or a good song title or even just a good concept to start thinking about for a song. And that's usually where song ideas start. And then from there, I just put together those thoughts that go together and then just work on building lyrics from there. And at that point, I'll take the lyric that I think is cool and I'll think of the last six or seven little guitar doodles that I've been working on and think which one feels kind of like the same concept, and I'll put those together and then I start actually writing the song. So I don't know if that answers your question, Renee. It's a process. I did a lot of writing in college. I was involved in a bunch of different writing. I took some songwriting classes. I was in some songwriting groups that Monday night, I think, we would go to this coffee shop and play our new songs. So it was just a cool creative environment. I did some co-writing and just lots of performing and stuff like that. So immersing yourself into songs and really analyzing songwriting can be a great way to kind of kick yourself to do a better job as well. And that goes for recording as well. Listening to recordings really trying to analyze those recordings and what they did to get those sounds from a recording standpoint. That's a great place to get some inspiration as well. Next up, this is another question. It's just too long. It's like two huge paragraphs. I just can't do it. Next up is Ollie from England. And Ollie's asking about multiband compression. It says, "Hey, Joe, where are you going?" Sorry, I just referenced Hendrix. Anyway, people do that to me all the time. Ollie did not do that. It says, "Hey, Joe, where are you on using multiband compression on individual instruments within a mix? For instance, bass. Is there an advantage being able to have a slower attack at 80 hertz and a quicker attack at 200. Hope that makes sense. Cheers, Ollie." I love British people. They're always saying cheers. It makes me happy. Good question, Ollie. For multiband compression, I only use it for mastering. And that's just because it's such a complex tool that I can easily screw up. So I try to just leave it for mastering. So that's just my personal take on it. Would it be helpful perhaps to have multiband compression available for vocals or for bass and to really have all that adjustability there? I think that could work. I say try it if you're interested in that. But for me, I'd rather just use a regular compressor and regular EQ and get that sound how I want than having to resort to multiband compression, because I feel like it could introduce more issues than it helps for me personally. So that's where I come down on it. Good question. Next up is Samira, and Samira is actually, I believe, one of my new production club members, so thanks for joining, Samira from Chicago, and he's asking how relevant the production club is for someone producing an audio-only podcast. Says, "I'm gearing up literally and figuratively to create a few training products. I want them to be of highest quality. There will be a bit of music interspersed in the final product as well. Would your course be overkill?" That's a good question. My course is designed to talk about recording a song from start to finish. So pre-production, recording, editing, mixing, and mastering would be involved. So if you're not doing, you know, pre-production on the tutorial product, I could see how that would apply. The recording of the product, certainly, for at least the vocal part. Editing would apply somewhat. Mixing and mastering, depends on what you're mixing and mastering. If you're just using stereo already created music, that's not going to be too helpful for you as far as mixing goes, because you're not going to be doing a lot of mixing. But for mastering, yeah, you'll want to master that final tutorial product if you want. Put it through a mastering phase, you certainly could. So I don't know if the course applies to podcasting per se. There's a lot of stuff you can apply to podcasting, but it might be a bit overkill as far as if that's the only thing you're ever going to do with music. However, if you're going to get into doing music creatively and you're going to record music, it's absolutely the best thing I've got right now as far as that goes. And for those of you who don't know what that's all about, you can check it out at hscproductionclub.com. It's now open, accepting new members every day. Would love to have you be a part of it. And there's no deadline to join. Join whenever. Love to have you. Next up is Paulo from Portugal, and his question is about overall volume. It says, "Hello, Joe. Well, I've got a problem with the overall volume of a track. I recorded acoustic guitar through a Profire 610 in a Rode NT2A, but the volume of the track only reaches one quarter, more or less, of the meter. Is this a bad thing? Thank you." Paolo, I believe last week I talked about in the Ask Joe, one of the last episodes, I talked about setting levels for recording and how in a digital system with 24-bit recording, you don't have to have it super hot, a super hot level to get a good sound. That said, if it's down only a quarter of the way up the meter, you may have an issue just with signal to noise in that your loudest part is only a little bit louder than your quietest part, and the quietest part being just the noise floor of your system. So if is it necessarily going to be a problem? No, it's not a problem by default. Could it be a problem? Yes, because you could end up, once you mix everything and get everything to a nice loud level, you may notice that that noise floor of your system is a little more noticeable than it could have been. So that's why I recommend recording maybe halfway up the meter to halfway to two-thirds or so. Not trying to peg the meter and get as close as possible, but also not super, super low. At the end of the day, it really just matters if your final mix sounds good. Noise is not the worst thing that could happen, but it is something to keep in mind and consider, and that's one of the reasons why you want a healthy level, but you don't have to go overboard and have a super dramatically loud level. Got a couple more questions and we will be done. Next up is BB from Philadelphia. Philly has a question on positioning of the interface versus the DAW. This one's a little long. I'll summarize. It says, I'm wondering if you can provide some guidance on setup for recording and mixing. The primary interface is a Mackie Onyx 1640 mixer, 1640i, positioned between near-field studio monitors on either side. Mackie is a FireWire running to a PC running Pro Tools 10, which is located on the right, with up to 16 channels, which can be routed to the Mackie channel strips. My understanding is that one can use both the Mackie channel strips and the mouse/keyboard for the mixing function simultaneously. My concern is that if I am turned towards the PC video monitor while mixing, this is not an ideal listening position if actively adjusting levels, EQ, compression with the keyboard and mouse. So the question is, should I swap position of the Mackie in the PC video monitor so that the PC video monitor is in the center between the reference monitors? Good question. A lot of times people talk about the ergonomics of a studio, and some of it's just personal preference, but I think you make a good point. You do want to have your head between the monitors while you're making critical decisions. That's not to say you can't reach over to the side and make an adjustment and come back to the center. But for me personally, it doesn't even come down to the sound as much as I want the thing I'm going to be looking at 95% of the time, which is the computer screen. There's no way I would want that off to the side. For one, my neck would get tired, and two, I would never be facing my speakers entirely. So I would put that computer screen right in the middle, and if you have to move the mixer, fine. Ideally, get something where you can put the computer screen in front of you, maybe lift it up a little bit on a platform of some sort, and then have the mixer in front of you as well, and then a pull-out tray underneath for your keyboard and mouse. That's something I would do. For me, I've got my mixer off to the right because I don't need it. I don't use it for mixing. I use it for recording. And so when I'm mixing, I want to have a nice clean table in front of me, keyboard, mouse, my fader port, and then I've got two screens right in front of me and I'm dead center between my speakers. So that's what I would do. And BB had another question, but it was a little bit longer, so I'm trying to cut back on the long questions. And last up is Andreas from Stockholm, Sweden. Andreas is another one of my customers. He's done mixed with us, and I believe VIP as well. And Andreas says, when I use the function bounce in place in Logic Pro, and in this case bouncing a MIDI bass track, it automatically becomes a stereo audio file. I know how to do it the right way so that it will become a mono audio file, but that takes a while to do, and there are it's a little bit confusing sometimes. Now when the bass becomes a stereo audio file, I therefore use stereo plugins on that bass track. Is this something that I'm going to avoid, or should I just carry on the easy way I do when I bounce? This doesn't happen when I use the function turn all tracks to audio files, but sometimes I want to bounce a specific region. That's a good question. I'm not a Logic user, but essentially what he's doing, he's got a bass track and he wants to essentially print those effects that he's using on that track, or if it's a synth bass, he wants to print that sound and not have to continually run that virtual instrument. And it sounds like whatever plugin that you're using, okay, it is a MIDI bass track, I see that there. Whatever plugin you're using to create that sound, that's a stereo plugin. So if you can open a mono version of that plugin, then all your problems are solved. So if it's the EXS24 sampler, I think that's what it's called inside of Logic, if they have an option to open that as a mono file, or as a mono source, then I would do that, and then it should bounce it down as mono. At the end of the day, is it really going to make a difference? Probably not. You could bounce it as a stereo file and then just make sure you're panned the left and right to the center, and it's essentially the same thing. Or you can do the harder work to make sure you bounce it down to an actual stereo file. Or if you're not really choking your computer, you can just leave it alone and just let it play. Again, that if you're doing a lot of MIDI stuff, then maybe you do want to do that to save on some resources, especially if you start getting some pops and clicks and all that fun stuff. But that would be my, those would be my couple suggestions for you. Things to try. All right, well, that about wraps up this episode of Ask Joe. Thanks again for those of you who listen. If you haven't already signed up to my daily newsletter, you can do so at homestudiocorner.com/newsletter. You'll get my daily tips delivered to you and a copy of my free ebook, 31 Days to Better Recordings, which is a really cool 31-day process for just really taking a good hard look at your recording from start to finish and things you can do to improve those. And if you have a question for me on the podcast, I'll do my best to answer those as a part of a future episode. You can ask those at askjoegilder.com. That's Gilder, G-I-L-D-E-R, askjoegilder.com. And please keep those questions brief so I can do as many during an episode as possible. And that'll do it for now. So thanks again. Really appreciate you listening, and see you on the next episode.